Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tenzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Thank you for spending part of your day with us. Now, it's June 1, the first day of Pride Month. 4 weeks of marches, actions, celebrations, protests, and proms organized and led by LGBTQ+ communities across the globe to ensure visibility, build solidarity, and create change. Pride is also the annual commemoration of the 1969 Stonewall Rebellion, the watershed week when the patrons and community of Greenwich Village's Stonewall Inn collectively resisted police violence and harassment.
It was a release of energy. They could now fight back for all the times they had to slink away without being able to say anything and take whatever crap the cops were giving at them. And once it broke loose, it was very contagious.
Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine, who led the raid, speaking in an interview from 2004. And that's the reminder that Pride Month is not only about cultural and community celebration, it is also about politics. A point President Biden made explicit in his address to Congress in April.
I also hope Congress will get to my desk the Equality Act to protect LGBTQ Americans. For all transgender Americans watching at home, especially young people, you're so brave. I want you to know your president has your back.
And President Biden's backing is especially important right now. More than 30 states have introduced bills targeting the rights and freedoms of transgender people. All this while transgender youth and adults faced outsized rates of homelessness, incarceration, and vulnerability to violence. With me now is Kate Sossin, LGBTQ+ reporter at the 19th. Kate, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Melissa, and happy Pride.
Happy Pride. Now, I actually want to start by having you walk us through what some of this legislation has been that's been introduced in states specifically targeting transgender folk.
Yeah, the main two types of bills are what we call medical youth bans. These are bills that prevent transgender youth from accessing affirming medical care. For the most part, these are puberty blockers. So when kids hit an age where they are at an age where they would be comfortable transitioning, then they might be able to. But in the meantime, while they're figuring that out, they can go on a puberty blocker that just prevents them from experiencing development in a body where they wouldn't be comfortable. So this just pauses puberty. Those bills prevent kids from accessing that medical care that providers have found is really, really effective in preventing mental duress and suicides. The other kind of bill are these trans sports bills, which we've seen a lot of in the media. And this says that, you know, trans girls especially cannot play on sports teams with other girls. And those bills we've seen pass at really alarming speeds. Last year, we only saw this pass in one state. And now we have 8 states that have passed these bills.
Can we start by talking a little bit here about where these bills come from, right? It's not an accident that we see several dozen states all at once seeking to pass legislation that is quite similar. Where are they getting these bills?
That's a really good question. So we actually found there's a website that generates this legislation. So you can just log in and request a bill. And this is done by a coalition of anti-LGBTQ organizations, a number of them that have been labeled hate organizations by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And so you can just go in and fill in what kind of model legislation you want, and they will generate a bill for you. That's part of it. The other part of it is that these kinds of bills have been sort of generating and kicked around for years. So after the advent of marriage equality in 2015, the focus both in the LGBTQ community and then people who opposed LGBTQ rights shifted to trans rights. And we saw bathroom bills in 2016, and that campaign largely failed. And the shift went to trans kids, because how many of us really know trans kids? Not a lot, right? Less of us know trans people than gay people, for example, and even fewer of us know transgender children. That's an issue that's much easier to legislate around, because few of us actually know the people that are impacted.
Right. So it's this bizarre reality where on the one hand, there is no problem here to solve, right? There's not some fundamental crux of anxiety in middle schools where trans kids are, sort of overwhelming the sports teams. But, right, the problem that it creates, right, so it's not solving a problem, but it is creating a problem, right, for vulnerable communities. Talk to us a little bit about, for example, the economic vulnerability of trans folks, and particularly trans folks of color, and how COVID really revealed so much of this economic vulnerability.
This is a really important question, I think. So, in the worst year that we had ever seen for transgender homicides was 2017. And in 2017, we had 27 reported transgender homicides. It was a crisis unlike anything we'd ever seen. In 2020, we had 44 trans homicides. So COVID and the pandemic pushed trans people, mostly Black trans women, further to the margins. And trans people in general experienced unemployment at 3 times the general population, according to the last survey we have, which was in 2015. Now, this year, before Pride Month, which is when we always see an uptick in trans homicides, we're already at 27 transgender murders. We're almost doubling the pace of what we saw last year already. And most of those deaths are transgender women of color. So, and a lot of advocates are saying that it's the pandemic and it's also these anti-trans bills. So what we're seeing is these bills that are passing in states like Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, South Dakota, Montana, places where you don't necessarily have huge populations of transgender women of color. But then we're also seeing the homicide rate of Black trans women tick up in states like New York, in cities like Chicago, where we do have these high populations of Black trans women. So the crisis is being felt across the country, and these bills are impacting trans people everywhere.
So important, it feels to me, to recall that even in moments that are this painful, and I feel like I can almost hear the pain in your voice about this vulnerability, this violence, this kind of almost legislative violence over and against folks relative simply to identity, that at the same time, there's always resistance that exists in these moments as well. Can you talk about the ACLU's decision to sue the state of Arkansas over an anti-trans law?
Yeah, the ACLU has gone to bat against, so Arkansas has a trans medical ban, so it prevents transgender youth from getting the care that all the major medical associations have found, is appropriate for transgender youth. And they are suing that. And Chase Strangio, who's a prominent trans attorney, has been at the forefront of this. So that is really critical. And the other thing that I want to point out, especially as we sort of head into Pride Month, is, especially in the pandemic, trans people have really been sort of leading the charge in taking care of their own in terms of housing, in terms of food, in terms of mutual aid. And that has been really critical care for a lot of people, especially in the South. There have been a number of programs, housing programs, and there is a real story of resistance, and part of that is these lawsuits, and then part of it is transgender women organizing for each other, knowing that help is not necessarily on the way, especially during the Trump administration, which a lot of people saw as hostile to transgender people. And so that aid has been there. And I think that's a really important and also, I think, a bright spot in all of this.
I so appreciate you saying that. I'm very excited that this month I'm partnering with PFLAG, and we are doing a series of conversations with queer and trans folk of color throughout the country who are doing exactly that kind of organizing. And the opportunities I've had to have some of these conversations has been absolutely extraordinary. House of Tulip down in New Orleans, and in fact, a little bit later in the show, we'll talk with Taylor Alexander of Southern Fried Queer Pride. So indeed, that sense of collective work on one's own behalf has been critical to this aspect of resistance.
Absolutely.
And have there also been, it feels to me, again, even in this difficult moment, there have been some spaces, some states where there have been efforts to actually expand rights for trans community members. Where is that happening?
You know, Vermont actually struck down its trans panic defense. So this is a really important thing that has been happening in states. The trans panic defense is when in a number of states actually still have this on the books, where if you actually murder an LGBTQ person, you can claim that you panicked because you did not know that they were LGBTQ and were so overcome by rage that you killed them, and that is an actual defense.
It's kind of like the crying game 1992 defense, right?
Exactly. Yeah. California is a state that I've love to watch. In part, I'm from California, but California has really led the nation in LGBTQ rights. I have a feature coming out today that looks at one of the a really young policy person who's been working on this. But California has been moving towards banning infant intersex surgeries, which is really interesting. So if a person is born with sex characteristics that don't fit neatly in the binary of male or female, they are often subjected to surgery. And intersex rights advocates have been pushing for years to ban those surgeries because they can often be really traumatic and painful. And California has been working really hard to strike down those surgeries. Two pediatric hospitals in Chicago and Boston have gotten rid of those. And California has also started to enforce the Prison Rape Elimination Act for trans prisoners. So California is a great state to watch, especially as we look at Pride.
Kate Sausson is the LGBTQ plus reporter at the 19th, writing really important work around these questions. And again, Kate, happy Pride.
Thank you so much.
We just heard about the broad slate of anti-trans legislation introduced around the country. And many of those states are in the South, including the state of Georgia. Well, for Pride Month, I've partnered with PFLAG, the nation's largest family and ally organization, to bring important conversations on how queer and trans people of color are bringing change to their communities. In the series called What Makes Pride, we feature activists, artists, and movement makers. According to the Movement Advancement Project, 1 in 3 LGBTQ plus people live in the U.S. South, more than any other region of the country, and more than 4 in 10 LGBTQ plus people in the South are people of color. And although the onslaught of anti-queer legislation has a distinctively Southern flavor, so does the ongoing and effective organizing of queer and trans Black folk and people of color. One of those organizers joined me for the What Makes Pride project and also joins me now. Taylor Alexander is an artist and director of the Atlanta-based Southern Fried Queer Pride, a nonprofit organization empowering Southern queer and trans people of color through the arts. Taylor, so great to have you on The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Yes.
I'm thrilled to talk with you. We had this opportunity to speak a bit about your work for the PFLAG What Makes Pride campaign, but I really wanted to revisit because I'm so enamored of what you're up to. So let's just start with, what is it that Southern Fried Queer Pride does?
We do so many things, but really, I feel like what we provide here in the city and across the South is spaces and opportunities for people to create mirrors in the community so that they can see themselves reflected and also their other community members reflected. You know, even though it is 2021, Atlanta is a major metropolitan city, an LGBTQ capital, if you will. Sometimes it's hard to find spaces that people who experience life like us can be seen and feel validated in. So I think what SFQP does is that we create places and spaces where anybody can access them that are intentionally diverse and intentionally inclusive. And you know, I still say that's radical because we get to own and operate those spaces. We get to have the final say of how things are moderated. So I think that's really the biggest platform and the biggest takeaway that SFQP gives to the community.
It also feels radical to me because you quite intentionally state as a collective that you're pushing back against these confining narratives of stigma and statistics and struggle, and instead really thinking more broadly about what the whole human lived experience is at these intersections. What are some of the ways that you do that kind of resistance work?
Well, I think at the crux of who we are as an organization, of course, is using the arts to kind of build community and fight against these narratives and these notions. We started off, of course, as fighting against the idea that being from the South and being queer and trans didn't align, that you couldn't be both at the same time and happy. So what we do is that often we just uplift the narratives and the people that are already here, you know, our history of resistance, our icons, our legends, our own versions of the Stonewall uprisings. We have such a vibrant, beautiful history here in Atlanta and across the South. And that's really what we're trying to uplift against that narrative. And this looks like, you know, a multitude of ways, whether it's, you know, working with the local ballroom house communities here in Atlanta to put on the Atlanta is Burning Ball in 2018 and highlighting Black excellence in the ballroom scene, or creating spaces where Black trans people can see themselves reflected and have discussions and narratives that are beneficial and helpful to them and their community. It looks like a myriad of different ways, but it always goes back to making sure that the people that are being pushed to the side and further marginalized are the people leading those conversations and creating that kind of change.
When you talk about the arts as central, of course, as you know from our earlier conversation, I am all into night work. Let's listen to a clip of it. It is a song that you released actually back in 2017. And I go out each time it always hurts because you never think to put me first. And I would like to somehow know my worth because I've been putting in that night work. Now, I really do wish our listeners could watch the music video along with us. But Taylor, describe to us what that song is about and the ways that it is doing some of the work you were just discussing.
Absolutely. I wrote that song out of frustration, kind of being a nightlife entertainer. I'm a drag performer here in the city. I've been performing for almost 10 years. And when I was writing that song, it felt, it came from a certain different few places. One was constantly being pigeonholed as the one Black entertainer on cast. One other aspect was, you know, I'm doing all this work. I'm performing, you know, 3-4 nights a week. I'm out here networking. And I feel like sometimes people just consume my art as just like fun. And sure, it does have fun aspects. It is, you know, entertainment, but it's also a labor of love. It's also a, you know, full-time job. And I just wanted to feel the energy and the love that I put into drag and into music and into performing reflected back at me from, you know, show directors, from audience members and things like that. So when it ties into the message of using the arts to kind of build that sense of community, you know, I think it ties into so many different like aspects of that. You know, when I go out each time, it always hurts because you never put me first. Just, you know, that's one of the lyrics of the hook of the song. And that really just speaks to just basic respect for, you know, artists, period. Especially working artists, you know, some of us have multiple jobs and multiple hustles to make things work. But it also just brings back to the notion that entertainers and artists are creating culture that everybody consumes. And as much as we are consuming that culture, we also have to respect the creators of those of that culture, because without them, we wouldn't have that entertainment or that culture to consume.
And as you talk about consumption and culture and some level of gratitude and respect, I've also been thinking about the context of the past national election, two Senate races and a presidential race that had all eyes focused on Atlanta, on Georgia, on the voters there, and particularly on voters and organizers of color, but often the national language leaving out BIPOC, queer, and trans folks who were part of that organizing and efforts. How is sort of a more traditional politics also connected to the culture work that you're doing?
I think that in terms of the kind of organizing work and culture work that happens in Atlanta, Black and brown organizers, queer and trans organizers work 24/7, 365 around the clock. Even when there is not an election cycle, even when these people that we have elected, you know, sit in their positions in their offices after they've been elected and then go back and forth on promises that they've made to those communities. So I think what really stuck out in these past few elections is that, you know, suddenly all these eyes and attention were on Georgia and were on Atlanta and on these organizers who, you know, despite the narrative, have always been organizing and putting their energy into mobilizing the people. And sometimes they were erased from that, from the truth, erased from the real narrative of who was driving change here in Georgia, in Atlanta. So I really feel like, you know, last year we really saw those people who have been doing the work get their flowers. And I just hope that energy, that respect, can be reciprocated and can be continued, so we don't have to consistently fight this narrative that we're only active when there's an election cycle. I hope that people realize this is an ongoing 24/7 kind of community organizing spirit that we have here in Atlanta.
And when you talk about that reciprocal sense of respect in order to do that 24/7, 365 organizing, I know that you all have been working at Southern Fried Queer Pride to fund a Black queer-owned community space. Can you tell us how that's going?
So we, ever since we started as an organization, we wanted to have a community space. Contrary to popular belief, even though Atlanta is a LGBTQ capital in this country, we lack a lot of the staple resources and spaces that other big metropolitan queer and trans cities have, namely a community center. We don't have that here in Atlanta. And, you know, a lot of people don't understand that community centers offer not only resources, but also like accessible spaces for queer and trans people of all ages to get resources, to find community, to express themselves. It's something that large LGBTQ communities and even small ones need to kind of have a home point. So last year in 2020, actually, we launched a fundraising campaign for the space. And in less than a year, we raised $130,000. And this Pride Month, we are relaunching that campaign to continue fundraising, because a part of this goal is to make sure that we own this space. Because as artists, as marginalized people here in the city, we're constantly being gentrified out of our neighborhoods. We're being pushed out because a lot of us don't own that property. And we want to make sure these roots that we're setting down stay there. So we're super excited, and we definitely think that we can make this a reality, hopefully by, you know, early 2022.
Taylor Alexander, Executive Director of the Atlanta-based Southern Fried Queer Pride. You can hear more of an interview with me and Taylor on the P Flag series, What Makes Pride, every Tuesday in the month of June at pflag.org. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us on The Takeaway.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Last summer's global protests against white supremacy and systemic racism led to institutions from corporate America to municipal police, colleges and universities, philanthropies and media organizations, all to take stock of how race and inequality manifest in their work. And this included museums. Now, some museums are reckoning with their past in very tangible ways. This April, in a historic move, Germany announced it would return stolen artifacts currently in its museums back to Nigeria, including the priceless Benin bronzes of the then Kingdom of Benin. And in March, the University of Aberdeen in Scotland agreed to repatriate its Benin bronze. France also indicated similar plans this year. Yet some museums, including the famed British Museum and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, have not committed to doing the same, despite having sizable collections of looted objects, including Benin bronzes. For more on this, we're joined by Karen Atiyah. She is Global Opinions Editor at The Washington Post. Karen, always good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And also with us is Chika Okeke-Agolo, who is professor at Princeton University in the Department of Art and Archaeology and the Department of African American Studies. Chika, also thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So Karen, let's just start with why some of these museums in Europe have announced that they're returning these artifacts. How have they been framing this decision?
So obviously the latest, as you mentioned in your intro, Germany has pledged to return the Benin, its collections of the Benin bronzes back to Nigeria. And the framing was of basically of a almost of a moral obligation to do so. And it's interesting that we're even talking about this right now when it comes to Germany's history and past in Africa. It also, just over the past weekend, has agreed to pay out some 1 billion euros to those that it colonized in Namibia. But it's really this reckoning with the sourcing, with the history, with the violence of how these objects were stolen in these punitive, violent raids in the Kingdom of Benin. So it's been really intriguing to see Germany really taking this lead. And we do have to note that it's also because Nigeria has basically agreed to, they're constructing a museum to be able to house these objects back in Benin City. Again, thousands of these objects exist outside of Benin. And so now the arguments for so long have been that, well, there aren't museums, there aren't institutions that can safely have them, that can safely carry them. But there are now mechanisms and institutions in place that will house these objects in Nigeria.
Chika, I want to come to you on part of what Karen mentioned there around this question of the violent ways in which these objects end up in these European and American museums. Can you tell us a little bit about that history?
Sure. The history of the Benin artifacts is quite precise, simply because it's probably one of the most well-documented acts of colonial looting that took place in the winter of 1897, when the British Navy, under the pretext of what they called a punitive expedition to the Kingdom of Benin, which was the most powerful kingdom in what was called the Oil Rivers, that is today's southern Nigeria, the attempt to seize control of the trade in the region from the kingdom made it necessary on the part of the British to vanquish the Oba of Benin. And they did that in a number of ways, signing bogus treaties and so forth. But in 1896, one of their captains, British Captain Phillips, took an entourage into Benin at a time when he was warned not to enter the kingdom. It was an holy period. But he did anyway. He was attacked, and some of his men were killed. The British then used that as an opportunity to invade, burn down, and loot the palace. But before they went on that expedition, they had already sent word to the Foreign Office in England indicating that the palace had tremendous treasures, which, if they were taken back to England and sold, could pay for the cost of the expedition. In other words, they knew what they were going to do in the Kingdom of Benin, which was to embark on a military expedition, actualize the goal of empire, and still have the Benin people pay for it by virtue of seizing their treasures and selling them off to buyers, museums, and so forth in Europe in 1898, which was when the government of Britain organized the first auction sale just a year after the expedition. And that's how these objects spread across Europe and eventually the United States.
So that history is so critical and valuable to know, this idea that there was a clear understanding about what that choice was and the ways that it was connected to a particular kind of fiscal calculus. Karen, can you help us to then put that history into a contemporary context and say, why then does it matter for these objects to be returned?
So I think it is a really important point that was brought up. I mean, just about this history that even museums and many of these institutions were part of, in Europe, were part of the colonizing project, would send letters to militaries asking them to bring back these treasures. And I think, and not just treasures for you know, fiscal enrichment, but really as basically trophies of the conquest under the pretext that we, the victors, want to learn about those that we conquered.
Chika, maybe I can come back to you here because I'm interested in whether or not there's any argument for keeping these items in museums. And by museums, I mean museums that are not on the continent. How would these U.S. museums or European museums justify not giving them back?
They've had really several arguments and excuses, all of them really terrible, at best untenable. The first is that they claim that these museums in the United States and Europe, because they are well endowed, must keep the world's cultural heritage for humanity. This was the argument that some of the captains of the industry made in 2002 when they made a declaration arguing against the repatriation at the time of the Elgin marbles, the so-called Elgin marbles from the Parthenon that are presently at the British Museum. They, of course, were defending the British Museum's right to keep these objects for mankind. Or humankind. That was a major argument that they made. The second one was something that Karen mentioned earlier, which was that, well, you see, these countries, these societies where these objects were taken from don't have the resources to keep them. And so we might as well safeguard them in our fancy museums. But I've always thought that that argument sounded like someone stealing your fancy car and basically arguing that he could not possibly return it because your garage is so crappy. and then demand that until you build a nice looking garage for this fancy car, the car will not be returned. I don't see a difference, from the kind of argument that they've made. And that's why I think, and this point has to be made, the fact that the Nigerians are building a museum is not and should not be the good reason for returning these objects, because it buys into this idea that, well, poor countries don't deserve their stuff back. The principle is what is at issue. The Nigerians or the Africans can decide how they want to conserve their cultural heritage. And by the way, the Greeks built one of the best museums in the whole world, hoping that their Elgin marbles would be returned for the Olympics some years ago. Up till now, they have not been returned. So the argument about building new museums in Africa is really not what we should focus on. Good for the Nigerians that are building their museum, but that is not the reason why these European and American museums can now say, oh, well, now that they have good museums, we'll return them. What of the other countries that don't have the resources to build fancy museums? That is the question.
Oh, I so appreciate that analysis, Professor. And not only that that it's a fancy car in the fancy garage, but also that it was stealing the fancy car that made building the fancy garage even possible in the first place. Karen, let me come to you on this, because there's this kind of moment in 2018 where this breaks through in popular culture in part through the film, The Black Panther. Let's just take a listen for a quick second, Karen.
Tell me about this one.
Also from Benin, 7th century, Fula tribe, I believe.
Nah.
I beg your pardon.
It was taken by British soldiers in Benin, but it's from Wakanda, and it's made out of vibranium. Don't trip, I'm gonna take it off your hands for you.
These items aren't for sale.
How do you think your ancestors got these? You think they paid a fair price? Or did they take it like they took everything else?
Karen, I have to say, I know a lot of people are Wakanda forever. I'm actually Killmonger forever. And this was one of those moments. But the very fact that this was in a 2018 film suggests that this has been in conversation long before the summer of 2020. Can you talk about sort of what the long-term movement to repatriate these artifacts and treasures has been?
Absolutely. Yes. Team Killmonger all the way, especially with that scene. And I think listening to that scene also brings up a really important and sore point for museums, which is that, you know, in that scene, Killmonger, who is Black and who is knowledgeable about the history and culture of, well, you know, the fictional Wakanda, but of Africa, knows more than the white British curator who's presenting herself as the expert and the safekeeper of African culture and art. And I think this question about safety of objects, we do know that institutions here in the US in particular have come under a microscope when it comes to the fact that many museum staff, curators are very white, and that Black and African curators are rarely afforded the opportunities to be able to even be able to curate and present exhibits and make decisions about our own heritage and culture. So, you know, when I wrote about this, I just grappled with this question of when Western museums say, well, things are safe, but yet not even giving the opportunity to diversify the space, to create spaces for Black people and Black community to even come and have this dialogue, right? So it's sort of like how for museums to say that they want to have these conversations, that they want to present, you know, these dialogues on all of humanity, and yet they refuse to basically desegregate and basically in include and empower Black people for us to talk about our own histories and art.
Professor Okeke Agolo, on our last moment here, or last minute here, can you just build on Karen's point and say a bit about what U.S. museums need to be doing in this moment around racial justice?
Well, the U.S. museums, as I've said in some other forum, have been behaving like the ostrich. In other words, for them, this is not the problem of the United States. Rather, it's Europe's problem because the colonizing nations are in Europe. But the fact that Germany, which did not invade Benin, decided this year, as you mentioned, to return the artifact, makes it necessary for U.S. museums to step up and tell us what they are going to do about the looted Benin artifacts in their collections.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining us today. Karen Atiyah is the Global Opinions Editor at The Washington Post, and Chika Okeke-Agolo is a professor at Princeton University in the Department of Art and Archaeology and the Department of African American Studies. And it's your turn, people. Last week on the show, we talked about Black joy, and we asked you to share how you find, cultivate, and celebrate Black joy. Whew, y'all had a lot to share.
My name is Dorethea, and I'm calling from Oakland, Berkeley, California. And Black joy during the pandemic for me is getting in my car and driving through Black neighborhoods and watching the kids play, watching little babies run up and down the street. That's what I'm watching, people, watching Black people do their thing in my car, safe from the pandemic. That was my Black joy over the year. Plus, hugging my grandson, who I live with. He was the only person I could hug all the time.
What brings me Black joy is seeing our people find ways to innovate and reinvent themselves with business in new ways to climb to greater heights. It brings me joy every time I pass another Black person on the street and see that look in their eyes that says, we are overcoming. This is April Harley from St. Petersburg, Florida, visiting my daughter's school in Philadelphia. Woo-hoo!
For me, Black joy is about humor, healing, leaning into community, be that family, be that quasi-family, be that friends. In every moment, being grateful and proud of the fact that I am a beautiful Black woman.
Hi, this is Lexi from Newark. To me, Black joy means being in a safe space where you can dance and sing and laugh loudly, and you don't have to worry about the cops coming to break it up because they hear a lot of noise. You could just be free and be yourself. Thank you.
So Black joy to me means watching a universal statement being made over and over, that no power in earth can ever wipe out any one race with violence, hostility, and unacceptance. Black joy to me is seeing celebrities like Taraji P. Henson and Vivica A. Fox show concern for mental health in the Black communities. Also, having a loving daughter who is also a friend, and seeing her son, my grandson, get his 2021 BS degree, summa cum laude, in environmental science. And lastly, the hope that Black families that have been torn apart and down by different things brought on by inequalities and injustices will reconcile with one another in love. My name is Sharina, and I am in Spring Hill, Florida.
Hi, my name is Laura, calling from Brooklyn, New York. To me, Black joy is a deep sense of elation. It could be about almost anything. For me, it's in singing, sometimes alone, sometimes with my gal pals, going out with them and just laughing our heads off about everything and nothing. We enjoy night on the town every once in a while. Could be out dining, could be out to a concert, reminiscing over old time. That's, for me, the essence of Black joy.
Hi, this is Isabel calling from Harlem, and one thing that has helped me tremendously is to see visions of Black joy. And one way I've done that is to follow Black midwives and Black doulas, and seeing Black babies be born and happy families has really helped me a lot.
Black joy for me is about knowing that I have a right to joy. It is about staying in my joy so that my body is as healthy as it can be, so my mind is as strong as it can be, so that I can enjoy my life. That is Black joy.
Thank you for your visions of black babies being born, of grandbabies being hugged, of accomplished young people commencing into their adulthood through their college graduations. Thank you for leaning into family and community, for laughing loudly, for going out with your gal pals, for singing at the top of your lungs, and for sharing your black joy with us. That's a wrap, folks. I hope you enjoyed the show today. I know I feel some serious joy being here with you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Talk with you tomorrow.